Good morning, everyone. My name's Alison Smith. I'm a curator at Tate Britain and one of the investigators on the Sublime Object Research Project. I'd like to welcome you to the second day of our conference, The Sublime in Crisis. We had some fascinating papers yesterday, and there was a very lively discussion at the end, which included one question about periodization. Was the sublime relevant at particular moments in history? When was it actually in crisis? Now, this is highly relevant to today's session when we focus on the second half of the 19th century, a period which does not feature significantly in literature on the sublime. It doesn't feature so much as the early part of the century, which we tend to associate more with the romantic sublime. So we hope the papers today will open up some exciting new perspectives on the subject. Now, there'll be 8 papers altogether, and so that we don't fall behind in our schedule, it would really help if you could restrict your questions at the end of each paper to points of clarification only, because there'll be plenty of time for more general debate in the discussion sessions. I'm afraid, as with yesterday, coffee, lunch and tea aren't provided, but you can obtain refreshments in the cafe in the main building. And the easiest way to access that is to go into the Clough foyer, then across the lawn, and then enter the gallery through the main entrance. And please try to be back on time so we can start punctually. Now it's my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Hilary Underwood. Hilary teaches history of art at the University of Surrey and is also curatorial advisor to the Watts Gallery in Compton. Her most recent project was curating the exhibition on Watts's religious art, Parables in Paint, which was held in the crypt of St. Paul's Cathedral earlier this year. And the intriguing title of her paper this morning is Sweetness and Light Falls on the Sublime, Erosions on the Possibility of Sublimity in the Victorian Period. So welcome, Hilary.
Some years ago, I was preparing a course on the art of the First World War and reading Paul Nash's letters to his wife, the verbal counterparts to his famous paintings of the ravaged landscape of the Western Front. And on the screen is Paul Nash's We Are Making a New World. Paul Nash wrote, "I've seen the most frightful nightmare of a country, more conceived by Dante or Poe than by nature, unspeakable, utterly indescribable. Evil and the incarnate fiend alone can be masters of this war, and no glimmer of God's hand is seen anywhere. Sunset and sunrise are blasphemous. They're mockeries to man. Only the black rain out of the bruised and swollen clouds all through the bitter black of night is fit atmosphere in such a land. It is unspeakable, godless, hopeless." The language, groping to express a real horror and the new landscape of modern warfare, nevertheless struck me as strange and old-fashioned. It paralleled the language, the literary analogies, and the emotional involvement with the landscape that I was finding in accounts of the sublime landscape in the course I was preparing at the same time on British Romantic art. Yet there was virtually nothing to compare with it in the language used of landscape in the Victorian period, the main focus of my intellectual interests. This paper explores what happened to the concept of the sublime in the Victorian period and is designed to be wide-ranging as a sort of framework for the more detailed discussions to follow. In the second half of the 19th century, the sublime as a prestigious category of the visual arts became marginal, if not moribund. John Martin, painter of the apocalyptic sublime, ended his career in the early 1850s with a trio of large paintings on the theme of the Last Judgment. The Last Judgment, The Great Day of His Wrath, which is on screen, and The Plains of Heaven, and you'll see those up together at the end of room 9. The first two in particular press many of the buttons of the Burkean sublime, subjects of terror, infinities of height, depth, and vastitude, which are made all the more unmeasurable by the vagueness of darkness. Illustrating the changed position of this artistic category, these paintings did not begin their exhibition history in a prestigious London venue, a London art exhibition, but began an extended provincial tour of exhibition as single painting exhibitions in Martin's hometown of Newcastle-upon-Tyne. When they finally appeared in London, again exhibited separately, not at the Royal Academy, the Art Journal gave a distinctly reserved review. It was worth noting other reviews were more positive. Martin's last paintings seem to have appealed more to religious interests and popular millenarianism than to a London art public. This indifferent reception was largely shared by other artists who continued or attempted to paint scenes of sublimity in the 1840s and 1850s. Turner, Palmer, Danby, and in figure painting, George Frederick Watts. It's true that the hostile reception which greeted Turner's Snowstorm, Steamboat Over Harbour's Mouth at the Royal Academy of 1842 was prompted more by the experimental technique than the subject. But the technique, as Syrah explored so well yesterday, is surely a visual correlative to the experience of the storm and is surely the point and the greatness of the work. Turner is an atypical artist, but more revealing for my argument is the fact that Palmer's grand, rugged and associative landscape, King Arthur's Castle, Tintagel, Cornwall, which is in Oxford in the Ashmolean Museum, was ignored by the Art Journal critic of the Old Watercolour Society exhibition in 1849 in favour of his more domestic image of two people, cows and sheep sheltering from a rainstorm under a tree. When emerging young artists of the mid-19th century dealt with subjects associated with the traditional sublime, they depicted them in a very different spirit. The Alps had been a classic locus of emerging and developed sublimity. Remember Horace Walpole's famous summary of the Alpine experience in 1739. Precipices, mountains, torrents, wolves, rumblings, Salvador Rosa. And remember such paintings as de Lutherberg's Avalanche in the Alps or Turner's Fall of an Avalanche in the Grison. Early 19th century paintings. But this is what the 24-year-old John Brett made of the Alps in 1856. In the Glacier of Rosenlau, shown at the Royal Academy in 1857, Brett creates a small canvas, only 44 centimetres high. The background is swathed in mist and cloud. The trees at top left do demonstrate a vastness of scale, but to me they're hardly noticeable. All the attention is on the meticulous painting of the ice and the rocks. And with nothing in that crucial foreground to give a sense of scale, the sharpness of detail suggests nothing so much as a geological tabletop still life in which scale, grandeur, mystery, the overwhelming, the essences of the sublime are absent. If this snapshot suggests what I believe to be generally true, that in the fine arts in Britain, the sublime was generally moribund by the mid-19th century, I'll spend the rest of this talk considering why this should be so and examining some artists who did retain an attachment to sublimity. As the example of Brett suggests vividly, the dominance of artistic realism in the second half of the 19th century was profoundly inimical to the sublime. Artistic sublimity, Pasley Aravis's paper yesterday on Stubbs's pictures, which come earlier in the history of sublime, artistic sublimity tends to manipulate and distort the data of sense in order to enhance the emotional impact of the image. And this manipulation was encouraged by academic theories of art, which rejected slavish imitation of nature as merely mechanical in favour of transformations which reveal and appeal to the powers of the mind. And this is very vividly illustrated in the case of Ward's Gordale Scar. The small painted studies in Tate Britain have a greater topographical exactness. Grand as the scene they reveal, in Ward's vast 1815 Royal Academy canvas, as Edward Nygren wrote, the viewer can see how the artist consciously manipulated topography in order to achieve the statement he desired, which is that of the scene's psychological impact, rather than topographical exactitude. As you can see, the cliffs are heightened, the size of the cataract is exaggerated, and it's brought forward in the gorge. Sheep are eliminated in favour of a staffage of wilder, grander animals, and a stormy sky is added. Ruskin traces a similar process of imaginative transformation of topography in Turner's work, contrasting as an example Ruskin's own simple topography of the paths of Phaedo with Turnerian topography, where, as Ruskin says, the inventive power of the painter gives not the actual facts of it, but the impression it made on his mind. And I'm showing you here the two Ruskin illustrations from the fourth volume of Modern Painters from 1856. And I'm showing you here the Turner watercolour of the pass, which is in the museum in Lugano. Yet, Ruskin's 1856 text in Modern Painters 4, represents the idea of imaginative transformation in its moment of transition, shown by Ruskin's high praise in the text for pure topography as among the precious things, in many cases more useful to the human race than high imaginative work. And this was bodied out in the tenor of Ruskin's advice to Pre-Raphaelite artists such as Millet, Inchbold, Stillman, and Brett, which was for those artists to focus on the minute, exact details of their scenes. Mary Watts recorded how Ruskin's changing position in the 1850s affected his interest in George Frederick Watts's figure painting, and also the emotional impact on Watts of identifying with values which were being superseded. If we're looking for a crisis of the sublime, this is it, played out in an individual artist's experience. In the 1840s, Watts engaged with the highest abstract flights of history painting, using a visual language derived from the High Renaissance and Baroque art, especially from Michelangelo, a sort of figurative sublime. And although I'm going to be talking about Watts's Time and Oblivion from about 1848, I'm showing Life's Illusions from the Royal Academy of 1849, now in Tate Britain. This is Mary Watts on Watts's experience around 1850. Time and Oblivion. He, which is Watts referred to elsewhere as Signor, said Ruskin at first cared enormously for this picture and approved of his works in every way. And then, becoming more and more emphatic for the principles of the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, he went quite round and said he, Signor, was entirely wrong. He had the picture hanging for some time in his house in Park Street, having asked to be allowed to have it. But as his mind got round to other grooves, he ceased to care for it. And Signor, seeing that, took the picture away. Ruskin had come to care only for the faithful rendering of fact, and his mind seemed to close against Signor's views, which were that imaginative poetic works, material fact must be sacrificed to convey the impression, and exact imitation was out of place. Art was then in a deplorable state, and the PRB being the only artists who were deeply in earnest, their lack of sympathy with Watts's aims had a great effect on him.
He took to working with varnish and on panel.
He says he lost the better part of his life through this, and he was thus diverted from doing the work he had from his earliest time foreseen for himself. That is the crisis of the sublime. Ruskin was not isolated in embracing realism in the mid-century, but was an influential part of a widespread trend. Life's Illusions was panned at the 1849 Royal Academy. Palmer's Sheltering from the Storm was not praised for the Art Journal for its emotional content or dramatic weather, but because the tree was an interesting study. And when, as the Art Union, the magazine abused Turner's Rainstorm, Steamboat off Upper Harbour's Mouth, the underlying expectation of realism in its review is clear. The Art Union wrote, "Through the driving snow, there are just perceptible portions of a steamboat labouring on a rolling sea. But before any further account of the vessel can be given, it will be necessary to wait until the storm has cleared off a little. The sooner the better." Explanations for this change of sensibility are multifaceted. One could talk about the new presence of photography as an objective record. The dominance of new money, middle-class patronage is also crucial. These mid-century patrons were generally utilitarian and practical in outlook, and educated outside the elite culture which espoused connoisseurship and the academic tradition where the sublime had been fostered. The new patrons favoured realism and sentiment over grander traditions, and the Art Journal, whose reviews I've chosen to focus on, generally identified itself with this patronal group. Ruskin became uneasily aware that artistic realism lost deeper artistic and human qualities. Having browbeaten John Brett into painting the detailed image of the Val d'Aosta he thought he wanted, when it came to the Royal Academy in 1859, Ruskin found he didn't like it. A notable picture, truly, yet not a noble picture. It seems to me wholly emotionless. I cannot find from it that the painter loved or feared anything in all that wonderful piece of the world. There seems to me no awe of the mountains there. I never saw the mirror so held up to nature, but it's mirror's work, not man's. No emotion, no awe, no fear in that mirror's work. I could not find you a clearer statement that realism killed the emotional and transformative dimension of art upon which the sublime primarily depends. The aesthetic, or art for art's sake, movement developed in Britain in the 1860s. In the hands of artists such as Whistler, Rossetti, Leighton and Albert Moore, it reclaimed the high ground of artistic expression and style in the face of realism and of the sentimental and ideologically shaped narratives of popular Victorian painting. But this movement, the underlying ideas of which became dominant in late 19th century artistic thinking, also contributed to the decline of the sublime, except in certain specialised forms I'll refer to at the end of the paper. Contrast Ruskin with Walter Pater, leading writer of the aesthetic movement, as they formulate their ideas of artistic greatness. Ruskin, in his early career, declared, "The greatest art is that which conveys the greatest number of the greatest ideas." For Pater, by contrast, in its primary aspect, a great picture has no more definite message for us than an accidental play of sunlight and shadow for a few moments on a wall or floor, and is always striving to be independent of the mere intelligence, to be a matter of pure perception, to get rid of its responsibilities to its subject or material. The sublime requires an aesthetic such as Ruskin's, in which subject is given a place. Aestheticism favours an aesthetic of form, often marked by rejection of subject matter, exemplified by Albert Moore's A Garden from the Royal Academy of 1870 and in Tate Britain. As Whistler stated in The Red Rag of 1878, art should be independent of all claptrap, should stand alone and appeal to the artistic sense of eye or ear without confounding this with emotions entirely foreign to it, as devotion, pity, love, patriotism, and the like. Through Whistler's articulacy and through the influence of his ideas on the new artists and new art critics of the 1880s and 90s, such form-focused ideas influenced the development of British Impressionism and in turn the influential formalist strand of British modernism. Clive Bell in Art in 1914 asked, "What qualities shared by all objects that provoke our aesthetic emotions?" Responding, "Only one answer seems possible, significant form." So British art, in this emergent and prestigious discourse, were dominated from the 1870s to the period of the Great War by art theories which asserted that art was essentially something that appealed to an artistic or aesthetic sense or emotion, and that sense or emotion responded essentially to the abstract qualities of form. It's true that both Pater and Bell accept art where subject and form were what they call welded together, or at least found together, and that I hope we're going to be dealing with in the paper at the end by Charlotte on musicality. But the emotional and associative response to subject matter upon which the pleasure of the sublime depends is given an incidental place at best. Examine Bell's list of objects exemplifying significant form: Santa Sophia, Chartres stained glass, Mexican sculpture, Persian bowls, Chinese carpets, and painting by Giotto, Poussin, Piero de la Francesca, and Cézanne. And I have the Cézanne of the grounds of the Chateau Neuf from Tate Modern on the screen. It's a mix of decorative and figurative art, giving these two forms equal status. And notice that among the artists, there are no artists such as Michelangelo or Delacroix who combine powerful subjects and emotional power with formal quality. This sort of approach to art seems a striking retreat from the emotional potential of art. The cultivated concept of art found in aestheticism and formalism, dominant among the tastemakers in the last quarter of the 19th century, provide, I'd suggest, a version of the visual arts of the culture advocated in Matthew Arnold's influential Culture and Anarchy of 1869. This culture, Arnold defines as the best ideas of the time, knowledge divested of all that was harsh, uncouth, and I find that a significant word in the context, difficult, abstract, professional, exclusive. And Arnold defines this variously as Hellenism and the sweetness and light of my title. You'll recollect that Culture and Anarchy is essentially a polemic directed against the mercantilism and narrow nonconformism of the middle classes, Arnold's Philistines, but also motivated by social fear of working class energies, the working class Arnold's populace. And these include labour organisation, political and social demands, what Arnold significantly calls Jacobinism. His culture is a demand for, if you like, a new polite society to be diffused downwards, to diffuse these social fears. And I find other correspondences to these concepts in the widespread suppression of energetic popular cultural traditions in the 1870s and the 1880s. This begins to shift my attention from artistic production to its reception. The enjoyment of the sublime